Welcome to NTD Evening News. Our top story tonight, President Trump turning American energy into a geopolitical weapon. His warning for Iran and his administration's plan to squeeze the Chinese regime's influence out of Venezuela, Mario Tsu, and the White House. Protests erupt again in Australia during the Israeli president's visit to the country. In another development, the U.S. military withdraws from a base in Syria, handing over the keys to the new Syrian government. Jason Perry with the update. Today's show host Savannah Guthrie this morning posting a video that pays tribute to her mother. Meanwhile, a new surveillance video possibly linked to the Nancy Guthrie case. Arnie Richards has the latest. ICE is ending its surge in Minnesota. Border czar Tom Homan announcing the main reasons for the move. Jason Blair reports.
This is NTD Evening News, live from our global headquarters in New York City. Here's Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. President Trump wielding American energy as a geopolitical weapon, warning of a traumatic fallout for Iran without a nuclear deal, while repealing Obama-era greenhouse gas rules. And on the ground in Venezuela, Energy Secretary Chris Wright is negotiating oil revival deals to sharply reduce China, Russia, and Iran's influence in the region. We now go live to NTD's Washington correspondent Mario Tsu at the White House. Mari, good evening.
Tiff, good evening. That's right. And President Trump is issuing that fresh threat for Iran as the Pentagon is preparing to deploy its second aircraft carrier to the Middle East. That's in addition to the USS Lincoln, which is already there standing by in the Gulf. And when asked about the timeline for the Iran negotiations, President Trump said a deal could be reached anywhere within the next month. Take a look.
We have to make a deal. Otherwise, it's going to be very traumatic. Very traumatic. I don't want that to happen, but we have to make a deal. They should have made a deal the first time, and they got Midnight Hammer instead. And this will be very traumatic for Iran.
This comes a day after President Trump met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to talk Iran negotiations, with Israel joining the president's Board of Peace. President Trump says he insisted to Netanyahu that Iran negotiations must continue. Netanyahu, though, says he's skeptical about any deal with Iran and is lobbying the Trump administration to press the Iranian regime to scale back its ballistic missile program and end its support for terrorist groups like Hamas and Hezbollah.
The president believes that the Iranians have already learned who they are dealing with. He believes that the conditions he is creating, combined with the fact that they surely understand that they made a mistake last time by not reaching an agreement, may create the conditions for achieving a good deal.
Meanwhile, President Trump's laser focused on energy this week. He's repealing the 2009 legal finding that claimed carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases endanger public health, touting it as the largest deregulatory action in American history.
We are officially terminating the so-called endangerment finding. This action will save American consumers trillions of dollars and will lower the average cost of a new vehicle by close to $3,000.
And as he directs the Pentagon to power military operations with domestic coal, President Trump says communist Cuba is in, quote, big trouble. That's as Mexico sends humanitarian aid to Cuba, which is crippled by severe oil shortages. The Trump administration last month ousted Maduro, cut off Venezuela's subsidized oil lifeline to Cuba, and threatened tariffs on any nation supplying oil to the island. President Trump now celebrates the relationship between Venezuela and the U.S. as Energy Secretary Chris Wright negotiates oil revival deals there, touting how the administration is strategically using its energy policy to dismantle anti-Western regimes.
One of the problems in Venezuela, as you point out, is the huge presence of China, of Russia, of Iran. Hezbollah and Hamas, North American headquarters, are here in Venezuela. We want it to be open to less corrupt, honest American, Western American allies for business. We need to get our adversaries, particularly their nefarious activities, out of our hemisphere. The influence of China and Russia and Iran that has been very large in Venezuela will become very small.
Energy Secretary Chris Wright's three-day trip to Venezuela follows a $2 billion oil supply deal between the U.S. and Venezuela and a $100 billion reconstruction plan for Venezuela's oil infrastructure, which was promoted by President Trump. Tiff, back to you.
All right, Mari, thank you. Israel's president was once again met by protesters during his trip to Australia, where he honored the victims of a terrorist attack. And in other development, the U.S. military withdrew its troops from a base in Syria and handed the keys to the new Syrian government. NTD's Jason Perry has the update.
Pro-Palestinian protesters filled the streets of Melbourne on Thursday as Israeli President Isaac Herzog continued his visit to Australia. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese invited Herzog after the deadly attack on Bondi Beach, where terrorists shot and killed 15 people during a Hanukkah celebration. However, thousands of Australians protested his visit and voiced their frustrations over Israel's actions during its war against Hamas terrorists in the Gaza Strip.
We, as the Australian people, we've always felt passionately about values of fairness and mateship and equality and justice. And we are here today to send a very clear message that our government sits in complete isolation to the people.
The protests didn't stop Herzog from speaking to the Jewish community in Melbourne.
And I say to all those protesters outside, go protest in front of the Iranian embassy or whichever embassy they have. For heaven's sake, they killed and butchered their own people, operating a whole machine of an empire of evil against us.
And he gave this message to what he called the younger generation in the crowd, saying, quote, do not be afraid to show who you are. Herzog and his wife were set to fly back to Israel sometime after his speech. And across Israel's northeastern border, the new Syrian government has reportedly been taking steps to promote openness and the freedom of information. On Thursday, a so-called uncensored book fair was held in Damascus that would not have been allowed during the former regime.
Now, regarding Kurdish books, most of them are available here in Damascus, but they were all hidden during the former regime's time. Anyone caught with such books would be subject to questioning and investigation.
I have many friends who, when their homes were searched and these texts were found, it was like their death certificate, a death sentence. Many went to Tadmor prison.
And the U.S. military has reportedly handed over a military base in Syria to the new Syrian government. The United States Central Command said the base in Syria was used to help fight ISIS and added that the U.S. military remains ready to respond to any ISIS threat that arises in the region. Jason Perry, NTD News.
In the Nancy Guthrie case, Today's Show host Savannah Guthrie posting a video of her mother on Instagram this morning. Meanwhile, a new surveillance video recorded 5 miles from Nancy Guthrie's home has surfaced, and it may have caught the FBI's attention. NTD's Arlene Richards has the latest.
Today's Show host Savannah Guthrie posting a family video of her mother, Nancy Guthrie, on Thursday morning. Next to the video, she says, "We will never give up on her. Thank you for your prayers and hope." Later in the day, some new developments. Media outlet TMZ posting another surveillance video Thursday afternoon.
This video was shot at 1:52 in the morning at a home 5 miles from Nancy Guthrie's house.
TMZ founder and host Harvey Levin says the man in the video, who's wearing a backpack, looks strikingly similar to the one seen in the original doorbell cam video. On Wednesday, authorities released surveillance footage of a man wearing a mask and backpack standing outside of Nancy Guthrie's front door on the day of her disappearance. The individual appeared to be tampering with the doorbell camera. Levin says the new video is on the FBI's radar, but makes clear,
"We don't know this is the kidnapper."
In a separate post on Thursday, Levin says he received a second email
from the man who claims to know the identity of Nancy Guthrie's kidnapper.
Levin said TMZ received the first email on Wednesday from a person saying he would reveal who the kidnapper is if he gets one Bitcoin, which is currently just over $65,000. But so far, no money has been deposited.
He sent us this other email complaining that he is not being taken seriously.
In other updates Thursday, the Pima County Sheriff's Office posting two messages. One asking for any video showing suspicious activity from January 1st to February 2nd, 2026, within 2 miles of an intersection near the Guthrie home. And the other again stating that their offices will not be scheduling any news briefings unless a significant development occurs. It's the fourth time in about a week that the sheriff has declined to be interviewed. Authorities have been searching for Nancy Guthrie for 12 days, Local residents have put up yellow ribbons and signs that say, "Bring her home." Arlene Richards, NTD News.
The ICE surge in Minnesota is coming to an end. Border's R. Tom Homan cites the operation's great success with 4,000 arrests and over 3,000 missing unaccompanied children found, as well as a greater cooperation with state and local officials. NTD correspondent Jason Blair has more.
The Twin Cities, Minnesota in general, are and will continue to be much safer for the communities here because of what we have accomplished.
Border Czar Tom Homan announces the end of ICE Operation Metro Surge in Minnesota after a 10-week run.
As a result of this surge operation, we have greatly reduced the number of targets for enforcement action, and many criminal aliens have been arrested and taken off the streets.
Homan says some notable reasons the surge is ending is county jails are now notifying ICE when an illegal immigrant is being released, which is normal protocol in many other states.
We now have the ability to arrest criminal aliens in the safety and security of jails throughout the state,
as well as more help from state and local law enforcement when unlawful agitators act out against ICE agents making arrests and protesters who cross the line.
I have also received commitments from state and local law enforcement that they will respond if federal law enforcement is being impeded or assaulted.
Homan says the police have been following through on these commitments and making a noticeable difference.
I'm also pleased to report that we're seeing a notable decrease on unlawful agitator activity here in Minneapolis and overall throughout the state.
The drawdown also comes after two fatal DHS-involved shootings happened in the state last month, and some calling on agents to take a less aggressive approach in their operations. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz responded to Homan's announcement, saying, "The long road to recovery starts now. The impact on our economy, our schools, and our people's lives won't be reversed overnight." And Homan says, along with over 4,000 illegal immigrants being arrested, 3,364 unaccompanied children who went missing after crossing the border have been located in the state.
That's because the leadership of President Trump, these children were located.
The Border Czar says a significant drawdown of agents has already been underway this week and will continue into next week. Then command will go back to the local field office and ICE will operate as it normally does before the surge happened. However, extra personnel investigating fraud and unlawful agitator activity will remain, as well as a small footprint to make sure agitator activity continues to decline and local law enforcement continue to help.
I cannot remove law enforcement personnel while violence poses serious risk to our officers. I will not leave my officers in that position.
Tom Homan says he'll remain in the state a little longer to oversee the drawdown. Jason Blair, NTD News.
At a Senate hearing today, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison faced sharp questioning over immigration enforcement, protests, and public safety in his state. And federal officials described how ICE agents are facing violence and a lack of cooperation from local law enforcement. NTD's Chris Bob reports.
You cannot have an attorney general
certainly disagree
that
with
posts
that.
Pictures supporting Antifa with an expectation you are going to have a civilized, stable, safe community that works with federal law enforcement to deport criminals.
At a Senate Homeland Security hearing Thursday, Senator Ron Johnson pressed Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison on activism and resistance to federal immigration operations in his state. Ellison said he was aware of activist networks and encrypted signal chat groups and argued that such communications are protected by the First Amendment.
Are you aware of training for activists, Mr. Ellison?
Yeah, I'm aware of that.
Were you aware of that signal chat that was being used to deploy those people?
I'm aware it exists, but this is First Amendment activity.
The Minneapolis Police Department issued guidance in July saying that they would not even help with crowd control around immigration operations. And Minnesota Lieutenant Governor encouraged people to put their bodies on the line.
Were you ever concerned about encouraging, I guess, people to support you to go out and put themselves into harm's way?
No, we never.
Impeding and obstructing illegal law enforcement action. Did that ever concern you?
Sir, that never happened.
Tragedy was going to happen, and you encouraged it.
In the second part of the hearing, senators viewed footage from recent ICE operations in Minnesota and questioned immigration officials over enforcement actions in the state. Just hours before the hearing, Border Czar Tom Homan announced the drawdown of federal agents in the state.
Tom Homan being there and now saying we're going to reduce his presence in the street is a good sign and a good step forward.
If you just saw someone beating someone with a canister on the ground, would you think that's de-escalatory? Is that what
we're leaving out? What I'm seeing is a subject that's also not complying. He's not following any guidance. He's fighting back nonstop. The reason that CBP surged a bunch of resources into Minneapolis is because ICE couldn't go do arrests without being violently assaulted, and they were not getting support from state and local law enforcement.
ICE leaders also described escalating threats against agents and their families.
The week that Charlie Kirk was assassinated, there was a tweet that went out. It said, kill Charlie Kirk, kill another, there was another individual in that, kill Todd Lyons. That's the stuff that ICE, yesterday after the testimony on Tuesday, I went back to numerous death threats against my family. There was a videotape of my wife walking to work that people actively post. The cartels have actually posted the schematics to my home.
Operation Metro Surge has led to more than 4,000 arrests in the Minneapolis area, as the administration says its enforcement push has reduced public safety threats and shifted Minnesota away from so-called sanctuary policies. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Chris Bobb, NTD News.
The Department of Homeland Security is out of time as Democratic senators blocked a funding bill for it today. All other government agencies have been fully funded through September. But money for DHS got held up after Democrats demanded changes to its immigration enforcement operations. They took that stance after two civilians were killed in confrontations with federal immigration agents in Minneapolis last month. Nearly all DHS workers will remain on the job, but many won't get paid until Congress passes a funding bill. Agencies like FEMA, the TSA, and the Coast Guard will be impacted. The deadline to fund DHS is Friday night, but Congress is off all next week for the President's Day holiday. Many senators left after casting their final votes for the week. Senate Majority Leader John Thune vowed to call them back to Washington if Democrats strike a deal with the White House. The House of Representatives last night passing the Save America Act. It's a bill that would require photo ID at the polls and proof of citizenship when registering to vote. Are everyday Americans on board with the measure? NTD's Sam Wong was out on the National Mall in D.C. to hear from the people.
What do you guys make of the SAFE Act? Do you think this is long overdue, or do you think this is a little bit too excessive? What do you think?
I wouldn't say that it's long overdue. I'd say that it's timely. I think that we're to the point where it's completely reasonable to ask for someone to prove who they are before they're able to cast a vote in an election in the United States.
I don't think that what we've had in the past gives us true results because of fraudulent votes. But I think that this would help cure a lot of that.
Basically an attempt to steal the ability for people to vote.
On that note, do you think people should provide proof of citizenship when registering to vote?
Depending on what their individual state recommends, because the states have the power to control their voting system.
I mean, I think requiring that you prove that you're a citizen before voting or affecting policy in our country, I think it's very wise. You know, I wouldn't want people outside of my household making decisions for my household. So I wouldn't want foreigners that are not a part of our country making decisions on policies in our country.
I mean, on the voter registration card, it says I declare under penalty of perjury that I'm a citizen of the United States. I don't know that if someone registers to vote, if having voter ID at the polls is really necessary.
What do you say to people on the other side of the aisle who think that we need more guardrails in our federal elections?
If you look at the numbers, fraud in voting is such a minimal thing. How many voters can you find that didn't have the right to vote?
I don't think it's really necessary. I think one of the parties is trying to create a problem where there isn't one.
What do you guys say to people who think that this is a form of voter suppression, and to people who think that this is that there is enough guardrails in our elections? What do you think?
I think that people who say this voter suppression are being completely self-serving and trying to serve their own political needs. You have to show ID to do lots of things in your life, everyday life. And I think this is completely reasonable.
I mean, I would just ask, like, why would it not be necessary to prove that you're a citizen before affecting the policies that, you know, dictate how citizens live?
Coming up, the CIA targets China's military with a new recruitment push as Beijing purges its top generals. And here at home, the Pentagon moves to block China-linked farmland purchases. Jack Bradley reports. phony marriages and threats to U.S. national security. A transnational gang is allegedly bribing military service members to marry Chinese nationals. David Lamb has the details. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. The CIA is now openly trying to recruit Chinese military officers as informants. This comes just weeks after Beijing purged its top generals. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley has more.
The CIA publishing a new video for members of the Chinese military, seeking to turn them into informants. That's as the Chinese Communist Party has been removing dozens of its top military officers and placing them under investigation for over the past few months. Just weeks ago, two top commanders were removed, even including Xi Jinping's second in command. Look, if you're an officer in China right now, it may not have the most job security, and the CIA appears to be capitalizing on this with its new video showing a disillusioned mid-level Chinese officer and how he's fed up with the party. The video leaves a secure contact number to get in touch with the CIA. It's part of the agency's broader effort that started last May of sending videos into mainland China with instructions on how to securely contact U.S. intelligence.
The way to counter China is to go on offense. A lot of the people in China are not happy with what's happening. And they can be, you know, great sources of intelligence for us. We'll have more people inside, behind China's Great Wall.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon is teaming up with the Department of Agriculture to crack down on Chinese companies purchasing U.S. farmland, farmland unusually close to sensitive military sites.
Shortly after 9/11, U.S. forces in Afghanistan uncovered Al-Qaeda training manuals that specifically targeted America's agriculture.
China alone owns 265,000 acres of American agricultural land.
On top of concerns of espionage, officials say it's also about protecting the food supply. Under the new agreement, the Pentagon will coordinate with the USDA scientists to identify and stop these threats. They say adversaries don't just target the battlefields, they target systems that feed and sustain the country. Reporting by Jack Bradley, NTD News.
A transnational gang is facing jail time for allegedly bribing U.S. Navy service members. Homeland Security says the Chinese nationals arrange phony marriages with military members to get access cards and immigration benefits. NTD's David Lam reports.
A scheme involving marriage fraud, conspiracy, bribery, and national security. Homeland Security says 11 people were charged in Florida as part of an operation targeting a Chinese transnational criminal group. The gang allegedly recruited U.S. military members to marry Chinese citizens for immigration benefits and military base access cards. The fraudulent marriages took place around the country, including in Jacksonville, Florida, as well as in New York, Connecticut, and Nevada. According to the Justice Department, to create the illusion of a real marriage, the suspects took photos of the couples to create evidence that could be presented to immigration authorities to suggest that they were in loving, committed relationships. Quote, in reality, the conspirators had agreed to a payment plan whereby the U.S. citizen's spouse would receive a cash payment upfront for marrying the Chinese national, a second payment when legal immigration status was obtained, and a final payment after the divorce. Homeland Security says five individuals have already been arrested and that authorities are pursuing the six remaining suspects. Five people are charged with marriage fraud conspiracy between March 2024 and February 2025. Among them, several are charged with additional counts of bribery conspiracy, facing a maximum of 5 years in prison for each guilty conviction. Four former U.S. Navy service members are awaiting sentencing hearings after pleading guilty for their involvement. Last February, Navy reservist Raymond Zumba allegedly brought three suspects to a naval air station after hours to receive ID cards for an under-the-table payment. They were arrested the following day. David Lam, NTD News.
How can the United States work to protect freedom and human rights at home and abroad? And what can Arctic Frost and the persecution of Jimmy Lai tell us about remaining vigilant against the threat of tyranny? Hear from Senator Ted Cruz tonight on Capitol Report with Steve Lance at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Coming up, an Obama-era decision by the EPA, known as the endangerment finding, has served as the basis for regulating greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., including the creation of vehicle emission standards and more. It was repealed today by the Trump administration. A panel of guests join us to discuss the impact of this decision. Instagram's top executive testified in Los Angeles in a major trial over teen safety and mental health. The case could shape how social media companies are held accountable nationwide. Christina Corona reports. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. President Trump and EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin today announced the elimination of a 2009 decision that served as the basis for regulating greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. The decision, known as the endangerment finding, was established under the Obama administration and declared that six gases, including carbon dioxide and methane, pose a danger to public health and contribute to climate change. Regulations based on that finding include vehicle emission standards, the Clean Power Plan, and other limits on methane, oil, and gas. Joining us now to discuss the repeal of this finding are two fantastic guests, former Trump EPA transition team member Steve Malloy. He's currently a senior fellow at the Energy and Environment Legal Institute. We're also joined by former Energy Department official Bart McCoys. He's the president of McCoys Partners International Corporation. Thank you both so much for being here. Steve, starting with you, how significant of a move is this, revoking the 2009 endangerment finding?
You cannot overstate its significance. President Trump positioned this as the greatest deregulatory measure ever. I mean, that's true. Getting rid of this thing, if it holds in courts, will create trillions and trillions of dollars of benefits for this country, save us from the national security peril we are now in with China, where we've outsourced our energy economy to communist China in large part. So this is just, it's a magnificent move. It's long past due. Now we have to defend it in court.
And Bart, your reaction to the move and the impact of this?
Steve's absolutely right. And it's important that he mentioned China, because this finding underpinned the entire climate change agenda. It underpinned a switch from calling it global warming to calling it climate change, and to going to the Green New Deal and green power generation. And it was a huge wet, sloppy kiss to the Chinese Communist Party, because everything that stemmed from this decision, the whole climate change economy of moving toward wind power and solar power and other alternative energies flow batteries and all of those things were manufactured in China. None of them were manufactured in the United States. And it went away from coal, gas, and oil that the United States has been blessed with in abundance. And because it found, the EPA administrator made a finding that these gases endangered human health, it gave the government enormous power, frightful power, to regulate every aspect of American life.
There's a lot to unpack here. Steve, first, though, how could this play out in a state like California, and how will those changes trickle across the nation more broadly?
Well, California is its own problem. The problem with California is that they tried to issue standards that they could nationalize. That has failed because with the EV mandate, for example, California wanted to nationalize that. President Trump and Congress ended that possibility. So California is always going to be crazy as long as it's run by Democrats. This is not really going to affect that. This is going to affect the rest of us. California has the highest gas prices, the highest energy prices. It's a lost cause as far as I'm concerned, but the rest of us are not. And so this will lower energy prices. This immediate rule will lower car prices. It will lower gas prices. It will allow for consumers to have more money that they can spend however they choose. The the opportunity costs of climate change are going to be gained, not lost. So this is just a fantastic rule all around.
And speaking of the rest of us, Bart, what are the immediate impacts we could see from this? Which industries will see the biggest changes?
Well, I think you're also going to see not just car prices lowered, but you're going to see state emission standards changed, and you're not going to have older cars be kicked out of service so early anymore. You're going to see people able to hold on to their cars for a much longer period of time. And that's especially important for people who live at the bottom end of the economic scale. When I was a struggling teenager and working my way through college, I depended on being able to buy literally a car for $100, a car for $300. I wouldn't be allowed to drive a car like that today. It could never pass the emission standards. And so, and as far as other industries, the cement industry, the trucking industry, anything that depends on automotive things, anything that is carbon intensive, nearly every industry in America is going to feel an enormous weight lifted from their shoulders and released. I mean, it's like they've been trying to swim with bags of concrete tied to their wrists and their ankles.
And Steve, the president of the New York-based Environmental Defense Fund said this action will only lead to more of this pollution, and that will lead to higher costs and real harms for American families. Your response to that?
Yeah, first off, greenhouse gas emissions are not pollution. They're colorless, odorless. Carbon dioxide itself is plant food, essential for feeding the 8 billion people we have on the planet. Gas prices will come down. Car prices will come down. You know, the average age of a car on the road today is 12 years. In the 70s, it was 5 years. You know, if people turn over their cars more often, car prices will come down. It should be better for the economy. And plus, you know, there's construction equipment will be cheaper. It will work better. Truckers, they were coming after truckers. Truck costs are going to remain low. So, I mean, this rule is just going to help our economy work. I mean, think back to the Biden climate rules and the inflation they caused and the destruction in our economy that happened then.
And Bart, talk to us about the financial aspect here. What are the expected savings as a result of this move? How much can Americans expect to save?
Oh, I can't even calculate it, because every single thing that we purchase has been made more expensive by this rule. Mm-hmm. And I want to just point out, if I may, the awesome, in the old sense of the word, the frightening power that an unelected bureaucrat has. This finding, this rule, was not made by the Congress. It wasn't made by the president in an executive order. It was a finding signed by the EPA administrator. And I'll bet you nobody but Steve or me can tell you even the name of that EPA administrator. And I'll confess, I had to look it up because I couldn't remember. It was Lisa Jackson. Nobody even remembers right. her, but she signed this finding into law. And this little thing, just saying, we find that these six gases endanger human health, created a $1 trillion break or weight on the economy. Every single thing, housing costs, everything you can imagine, was made more expensive because we're sitting here trying to regulate carbon dioxide, which, as Steve pointed out, is a plant food. It's necessary for life. It's part of the green revolution. And as carbon dioxide levels have increased over the past decades, you've seen the greening of the world increase. I flew over North Africa, I don't know, 2 years, 3 years ago, when I was there as an election observer, and I was shocked at the green I saw in the North African desert that used to be completely brown, and there were spots of green where there never were before. These are not pollutants, and you know, the other benefit of this is there are going to be lawsuits about this. The left will sue immediately, and I'll bet you dollars to donuts that 2007 Supreme Court decision gets reviewed and is overturned and reinterpreted. So even those series of lawsuits, I expect, will redound to the benefit of American citizens.
And Steve, I want to go to your earlier point, because China has benefited from this push for so-called renewable energy technology, especially dominating that sector. What does revoking this policy mean for the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, this is bad news for them, because their plan to disable our economy and our national security was to sell us wind and solar. Not only are they the essentially the exclusive manufacturers of that, they also sabotaged that, along with utility scale batteries. You know, there were batteries that had to be taken out of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, a Marine base, because they had been sabotaged by Communist China. Communist China was green energy was soft power to just cripple our national security, cripple our economy. We still have a long way to go. We're still very vulnerable to Communist China, but this is a step in the right direction.
And Bart, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and what I get, I'm sitting here fuming, because as Steve was saying that, I was thinking of Joe Biden binding us ever more tightly to the Chinese yoke of slavery that they tried to put on us, and I think of the spying technology that the Chinese put into everything. We have been at war with Communist China for the past 15 or 20 years. We just don't know it yet. In every possible way, they were trying to constrict us, to circumvent us, and to trammel us in a cage of their making. And we've now burst loose from it.
Well, Bart McCoy, Steve Milloy, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Instagram's top executive took the witness stand in Los Angeles this week in a closely watched trial. The plaintiff is accusing major social media platforms harm children's mental health. NTD's Christina Corona tells us more.
Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, testified in court Wednesday in a case brought by a 20-year-old woman identified as Kaylee GM. She said she started using Instagram at age 9, later became addicted, and struggled with depression and body dysmorphia. Meta, the owner of Facebook and Instagram, and Google, the parent company of YouTube, are the two remaining defendants in the case, after TikTok and Snapchat reached settlements before the trial began. A central issue is whether social media can be considered addictive. Mosseri, who has led Instagram since 2018, acknowledged what he called problematic use, describing it as spending more time on the app than you want to or more than you feel good about. But he pushed back on the idea that people could be clinically addicted to the social media app. Plaintiff attorney Mark Lanier played an audio clip from a past podcast where Mosseri had said people could be addicted to any social media platform. Mosseri told the court he used the word too casually. Lanier also questioned Mosseri on Instagram's responsibility to protect minors, including internal debates over beauty filters. Emails shown in court revealed Meta leaders discussed banning filters that mimic plastic surgery, with some warning the company could be accused of putting growth over responsibility. Mosseri testified that Instagram later banned filters that promote plastic surgery in 2025, but said these decisions often involve balancing safety and user expectations. During cross-examination, Meta pushed back on the claim that Instagram is built to profit off teens. Mosseri said teens rarely click on ads and typically don't have much spending money, but Lanier argued young users can drive long-term profit. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg is expected to testify later in the trial. The outcome of this case could influence hundreds of similar lawsuits nationwide. Christina Corona, NTD News.
And we have some breaking news related to the kidnapping of Nancy Guthrie. That's the mother of NBC host Savannah Guthrie. The FBI is increasing its reward up to $100,000 for information. It says the suspect is male, approximately 5'9 to 5'10, with an average build. In the doorbell video, he is wearing a black 25-liter Ozark Trail Hiker Pack backpack. The FBI is asking the public to call its tip line, 1-800-CALL-FBI, with more information to, quote, help us bring Nancy home. We'll keep you updated on this case as more information becomes available. Coming up at the Olympics, Team USA star Chloe Kim aims for a third straight gold in snowboarding, while the men's hockey team looks to start off with a win. Dave Martin joins us to discuss. And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin. Dave, we've got some baseball news as well as college basketball, but let's start with the Olympics. How did Team USA do today?
Well, you know, Tiff, it wasn't their best day overall, but they still came away with a couple of medals here to stay near the top of the leaderboard. Now, first off, Jesse Diggins took bronze in the women's cross-country 10-kilometer race despite dealing with a very painful bruised ribs injury. Now, this is her fourth career Olympic medal, so big congratulations to her there. You can see her exhausted there on the screen. Now, also today in the women's snowboard halfpipe competition, Chloe Kim took silver. Now, she was the two-time gold medal champion heading into these games. Unfortunately, she suffered a shoulder injury about a month ago that's soon going to require surgery. Still did very well, though, despite that. So big congratulations to her as well. So the U.S. got a pair of medals out of 9 medaling events today. And look at the leaderboard here. Norway still on top with those 7 golds. They've got 14 medals overall, which is tied with the USA for the second most. Italy with 17 medals overall with the most, but they are just behind Norway in total golds there. I got to tell you, though, that women's cross country race, Tiff, I mean, that is one of the most exhausting races you could do. Up and down the mountain on those skis, it's not like the straight line that I was thinking it would be. As soon as they each reaches the finish line, I mean, they just collapse in exhaustion. It's true Olympic spirit right there, right?
All right.
Very impressive.
Sounds intense.
I was impressed.
Elsewhere at the games, Team USA men's hockey squad played their first match today, beating Latvia. What are expectations for this team?
Yeah, expectations here are pretty high. I would say for the U.S. team, probably to at least get a medal here. Now, they, along with Canada and Sweden, probably are the favorites. That the U.S. team had a good showing at last year's Four Nations face-off. Remember, they faced Canada twice, two very competitive games. U.S. split them, but Canada won the one for the final, so they won it there. This time around, though, these Olympics, we have NHL players playing for the first time in a dozen years. The U.S. has a very NHL-dominated team. Probably have the best goaltending group, starring Connor Hellebuyck, who's been named the NHL's best goaltender 2 straight years and 3 times overall. But the U.S., they have not medaled since 2010. Now, if you remember, that was the year they took silver after that heartbreaking gold medal game loss, overtime loss, that was, to Canada there in the gold medal game. Now, meanwhile, they have not actually gone gold since 1980. Meanwhile, the women's hockey team plays in the quarterfinals starting tomorrow. Women's team has finished, they've at least got a medal in 7 straight Olympics. And again, in there, it almost always comes down to U.S. versus Canada. 6 of the 7 women's Olympic events have come down in gold medal game, U.S. versus Canada. Canada has got them 4 of those 6 times. So,
all right,
they're good at hockey.
Good luck to Team USA.
Yeah.
Moving to college basketball news, though, the North Carolina Tar Heels announced that freshman star Caleb Wilson suffered a fractured hand in Tuesday's loss to Miami. Have they announced how long he'll be out?
Yeah, no timetable yet, actually. Now, this is his left hand, which is his non-shooting hand, but of course, you still use both hands a fair amount in basketball anyway, but this is a huge loss for the Tar Heels. So Wilson is a 6'10" forward. He leads the team in both scoring and rebounding, averaging about 20 points, 9 rebounds a game. He leads the nation with 66 dunks in the season. He's really a projected top 5 pick should he come out for the NBA this summer. We'll have to see. Now, apparently, he was injured in the first half of Tuesday's loss to Miami. He didn't check out of the game until, though, in the second half. Carolina ended up losing that game 75-66. Tar Heels right now, they are 19-5 overall, ranked 11th in the country. Fortunately for them, 4 of their next 5 games are against unranked opponents starting Saturday when they host Pittsburgh.
All right, well, shifting gears to Major League Baseball, the Philadelphia Phillies have released 2-time All-Star Nick Castellanos. Who's expected to take his place in the outfield?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be Adolis Garcia, who they just signed in free agency about a month ago. Garcia just played for Texas. Now, regarding Castellanos, after he was released today, he addressed his benching in a game last season. This is in September. He said he was pulled for a defensive replacement in a game in Miami last September. He then brought a beer into the dugout, complained to the manager about team rules. They said teammates confiscated the beer before he could take a sip. He then thanked his teammates for doing so. He was benched the next game, though, by the team. Now, meanwhile, Castellanos still owed $20 million for the upcoming season, minus whatever another team who signs him would actually pay for him, assuming someone signs him. I would think he's too good not to be. But he's still a very good right-handed power hitter, much like Adolis Garcia. Now, meanwhile, the team said they wanted to address the situation with Castellanos before their first full squad spring training workout, which will be on Monday. So I'm sure you're looking forward to the upcoming start of the baseball season here, Tiff. Maybe about 6 weeks away.
All right. Yeah. Well, on that note, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tiff.
And that's all for today's news. For round-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com/live or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.